Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
The official orthodoxy is that climate change is going to destroy. It's apocalyptic. We need Bill Gates to invent some magic new nuclear, and that it has to work really well with renewables. My view was climate change is real, but it's not the end of the world. The nuclear we have is fine. It's more than fine. It's actually better because we actually know how to run these plants. We don't need some new Bill Gates type plant. And that we don't really need renewables. If you have nuclear, then you don't need renewables, and renewables are bad for the environment.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunting you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we've got on a brilliant guest. He is an author. He is a journalist. He is a man of many talents. And this is the one and only Michael Schellenberger. How's
Zuby,
it going, Mike?
Great to be with you. Thanks for coming all the way over.
No doubt, man. So good to see you again.
You too.
Last time I saw you, we were both in Australia for some crazy reason. And
that's
now
right.
We're here in California, so a little bit of a distance.
Absolutely, yeah. A little bit worse weather, too.
Yeah, not quite the same, man. But how are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, great to see you.
Likewise.
World traveler.
I'm doing my best, man.
Doing my best,
trying to be like you. Michael, I know a lot of people are going to know you, but for those who are not familiar, please tell them a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I am a journalist by trade. I also have 2 books that I did in the last 3 years, Apocalypse Never, Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All, and San Francisco, Why Progressives Ruin Cities. And I'm passionate about the environment, about solving problems like homelessness and addiction. And over the last year, year and a half, I've been really obsessed with this increasing censorship by governments of people on social media, but also broader abuses of power by FBI and CIA. That's really been going on, particularly since 2016. So I've got a lot of different interests, but lately I've been filling out sort of this issue of civil liberties and free speech and trying to get our, you know, get some control back over our government, which is a little out of control.
No doubt, man. And I want to get into a lot of those different topics, but before we dive right into the heavy stuff, I'm curious to know a little bit more about you and your background. Can you rewind, tell us what you were like? What were you like as a kid and where did you grow up?
Oh, good question. So I grew up in Greeley, Colorado. My parents were from the Mennonite Christian tradition, which is a very kind of radical, pacifist, very Protestant in the sense of, making their own church. It's kind of a cousin religion to the Amish, which people are familiar with, but the Mennonites had cars. But it's a very strict religion. But both my parents were Silent Generation, moving out of that. It came to Colorado, much more liberal Christian. But I was raised Christian, very liberal family. My mom was probably more of an FDR type Democrat. My dad was probably more sympathetic with the new left. Mm-hmm. I was a very radical left boy and raised in the 80s. And I identify a lot with Generation X. I think that we had a lot of things right in the 80s and 90s, particularly around things like identity. So I'm very interested. I very much feel my generational legacy there. And yeah, basically from then, I'm 52 now. So it was 35 years ago, I guess, right? A long time ago, where kind of coming out of the radical left and starting to rethink some assumptions, particularly around the environment and nuclear power, I'm somebody that likes to think of myself anyway as being evidence-based, mm-hmm. and I was advocating for renewables and couldn't figure out how renewables could ever scale up to actually power all of civilization, and discovered that there was this huge body of research showing that that's a very difficult, if not impossible, task. In fact, that the Industrial Revolution probably wasn't possible with renewables. And then really wondered, why was it that environmentalists weren't embracing nuclear? Why was nuclear the enemy if it's this major source of zero carbon energy? Mm. And that really took me down a rabbit hole for a number of years, really from 2010 to 2020. And then I published that in Apocalypse Never, which is really a book. It's about environmental alarmism more broadly, but through the heart of it runs this question of nuclear, because it solves so many environmental problems. With nuclear, you have basically limitless clean energy. That means you have fresh water, you have, you know, limitless food. You solve all your scarcity problems without pollution. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't figure out why. And so I really wrote the book about sort of this Malthusian, you know, anti-human, anti-development ideology, which really is what so much of modern environmentalism is. And then after that book came out in 2020, it was a bestseller. It was very exciting. We then were in COVID, and I knew I had a chance to do a second book, and I knew that I wanted to do something during COVID, something local. So I did San Francisco. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's sort of there's a lot of stuff intervening in there. I spent a lot of time in Latin America working with left-wing political movements and leaders. I speak Spanish and Portuguese. I went to Nicaragua when I was 17 to help the Sandinistas. Very much attracted to the radical left in Latin America. And I guess you could say I'm a refugee.
That's interesting, man. I think particularly growing up in a Mennonite family.
Or post-Mennonite.
Post-Mennonite family. Because you said a lot of things there, which I think to myself and a lot of listeners sound like strange juxtapositions.
Yes.
So growing up, post-Mennonite, but Christian family, but you also said very liberal, and then you also said radical left.
Yes.
So in my brain, those things don't quite square together. So
that's right.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, it's a good question. I consider myself, in some ways, I think, if I look back at my work, I'm sort of a critic and historian and psychologist of the left and mm-hmm. what is the left. And there's parts of it that I still really love and identify with, particularly the parts around free speech and freedom of expression and creativity and the affirmation of life and the affirmation of human potential. Mm-hmm. And there's other parts of it that are much more dark and much more anti-human. So I would just say, yeah, I mean, I think for my mom was probably your basic FDR liberal, you know, but my dad,
what does that mean to modern listeners?
Oh, it means you want to lift people out of poverty.
Okay.
My mom grew up on a farm in Indiana. So they saw what we would call poverty. For mm-hmm. them, it was probably middle class. And my dad grew up his parents were principals and school teachers. My mom's parents were farmers. So there was some of that sensibility there. My father just sort of grew up with my dad. You know, my dad knew, we talked about Noam Chomsky. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about U.S. imperialism. When I was coming of age, there was a lot of debate around the role of the U.S. government in Central America. So there was a very strong anti-imperial movement. It was also the time of fighting apartheid in South Africa. So mm-hmm. there was a sense of liberal and left, I think, were more comfortably overlapping in some ways. There was a stronger sense of embracing heroism of major figures, whether mm-hmm. it's Nelson Mandela or Che Guevara or the Sandinistas. It was really before we get to this turn towards a kind of celebration of victim culture mm-hmm. and of what we might call woke culture that sort of celebrates, you know, being a victim or, you know, being oppressed as a permanent state and a permanent place of identity rather than as something to overcome. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things I've been very interested in, is how you go from a left which had been liberating in many ways and about human potential to a left that was really about telling people that because of their identity, they were stuck in a position of being oppressed mm-hmm. and sort of celebrating that and even starting to celebrate sickness and celebrate, you know, that victim status. And so people sort of competing over who has had it worse. And I think that was something that was really rejected by probably both my liberal mom and my left wing dad. I think they never wanted us to be that way.
Okay.
They made us work hard. They made us have chores. You know, we would say things like, that's not fair. And they'd say the world's not fair. Mm. So some of these things that I think are now coded more conservative.
Yeah. That's the thing that I find quite interesting, because a lot of the things that you said attracted you to the left, or you associated at least with the old left. I think a lot of people would hear those. I mean, even something as simple as free speech, people would hear that and they're thinking, what, conservatives support free speech more than the left does?
That's the saddest thing you can say. Freedom is even more coded right wing, yeah, right? So freedom is coded right, and now free speech is coded right. And in the 80s and the 90s, free speech was not coded that way. And the free speech movement, which was created in the 60s down the street from us here at Berkeley, definitely was not just liberal, it was left wing. Mm. You know, and I was going through, you know, James Burnham, famous American conservative, his book, I can't remember which one it was, but where he was sort of describing, you know, he was sort of making a case for some amount of censorship, you know, as a conservative. Well, that's completely reversed. So I do find myself, I think also because I'm a Gen Xer, and I think that, you know, there was a period when wokeism was emerging over the last 20 years. I was a little focused on energy and climate change. And climate change was becoming really crazy and apocalyptic during that period. I mean, arguably it was always an apocalyptic framing. But to then go into the Twitter files in 2022. Well, December 2022 and early 2023, was, and discovering that progressives were advocating all the censorship was sort of shocking to me. On the one hand, on the other hand, I knew that that was going on. I'd sort of seen it, but I continue to be surprised by the betrayal of the left of free speech. And it's, I think, one of the most disturbing trends there is. I mean, one of the graphs I've been obsessed with is this Pew graph showing that Democrats' support for government involvement in censoring things online went from 40% in 2018 to 70% in 2023.
Yeah.
I mean, that's for public opinion research, that's a huge change. Usually, you know, we look at public opinion, people are slow to change their minds. Mm-hmm. You know, most of us don't change our minds, or we change them very slowly over a lifetime or a generation, 15 years. So to see that in 5 years is shocking. And I think it had to do with the Trump derangement syndrome, with the sense in which Trump emerged that he was only elected president because he had lied and engaged in misinformation. And so
our podcast today is sponsored by Tolos. One thing I've upgraded in my routine over the last 6 months is wearing barefoot shoes more often. As someone who's constantly on the go, whether training or traveling, the shoes I wear matter. Tolos sent me a pair of their Archetype 2.0 trainers a few months ago, and I've been wearing them regularly ever since. Tolos are not toe shoes, so they don't make you look like a weird ninja turtle. Instead, they have a wide toe box with flat, thin, flexible soles. It's enough to protect your feet, but not so thick that they weaken your feet like regular sports shoes. What I love about Tolos is they feel great, and they're some of the first barefoot shoes that I genuinely like the look of. They were created by a friend of the show who used to play professional hockey, and today they're being worn by pro athletes all around the world. They're a game changer both inside and outside the gym. If you'd like to try them while also supporting the show, you can get 10% off using my code Zuby at their website, weartolos.com. That's weartolos.com, WEARTOLOS, and use the code Zuby at checkout for 10% off your order. Tolos, feel for yourself.
Do you know if there's any similar data from other nations? Because I wouldn't be surprised if that's something that goes beyond the Democrat-Republican split. I wouldn't be surprised if in other Western nations there's been a similar shift amongst the people on equivalent political sides.
I have not seen it, but I haven't really looked. And I would take your side of that bet. I would bet it's the same. I mean, I've been doing a lot of work on Brazil lately, and I think in Brazil, eerily similar candidate to Trump, President Bolsonaro, similar demands for censorship. Same thing in Europe. I mean, one of the questions we've been obsessed with is sort of how much of this is culture, like how much of this is coming genuinely from the people demanding more censorship, and how much of it is coming from, you know, the intelligence community, the deep state, the administrative state, you know, the CIA, the State Department, the FBI demanding this. I mean, we just traced a case in Brazil where the FBI was down there advising the Brazilian government on how to do censorship. I mean, that's really disturbing. So some of it, and the answer is always sort of, well, it's both.
Yeah.
You know, the people even in the FBI or the people in the security agencies or the people that are in the front group, the think tanks for the intelligence community, those kinds of people are the kinds of people that want to go out there and, you know, don't let them say that online. They're a particular kind of personality. So you're sort of getting that. We're getting a better picture of how it sort of comes from the bottom up and also the top down. And it's really constituted by a particular set of person that we all kind of know that not satisfied with expressing their own views in the open marketplace of ideas. They want to stop other people from expressing their views. They're actually out to censor or in a more sophisticated way to engage in specific disinformation campaigns.
Yeah. I want to understand some terminology because we've used a lot of different words here and political labels. I've noticed that you seem to use the words liberal or liberalism and leftism or the left separately. Mm-hmm. I think even when you mentioned your parents, you said that your dad was a leftist and your mom was a liberal. A lot of people conflate those terms. So when you're speaking in that terminology, what is the distinction between the left and liberals or liberalism?
Well, it's such a great question, Zuby. And there's a lot of ways in which I'm like, liberals are all on the political right now in the sense of liberals being the ones that, you know, want to protect freedom of speech or
classical liberalism.
If you think of it, you know, in the traditional French parliament after the French Revolution, and on the right were the ones that wanted censorship and the ones on the left wanted more freedom of speech. They wanted, you know, that's different now, obviously. So that's where the left-right stuff doesn't explain itself. I'll give you another example that's really wigging me out. After the call, so I'm from Colorado. So when the Colorado Supreme Court ruled that Trump could not be on the ballot, I call my parents, you know, I'm like, what do you think of this? And we're pretty different places now, as you might imagine. But it was my dad who was like, I think that they should let Trump be on the ballot.
Okay.
And it was more my mom who was like, I don't think he should be. So it's a, which is another confusing thing. I do find sometimes my allies on the free speech issue do come more from the radical left than from the liberal left. People like Glenn Greenwald or Matt Taibbi or Aaron Maté or some of the critics of American imperialism, more in that Chomsky wing.
Are those guys considered more radical left?
I think they traditionally had been. I mean, now Glenn Greenwald is
called conservative.
Yeah. for on Israel, right? There's sort of some interesting things going on there. Even Chomsky has this really, Chomsky's amazing quote. I think it's, I'll butcher it, but I think it was something like, it's a disservice to the survivors of the Holocaust to censor in their name.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in fact, as we learn more about what was actually going on in Germany in the 20s and 30s, they were censoring, the Weimar Republic was engaged in censorship against Nazis.
Yeah.
Our view, of course, as Americans, is that better to let the Nazis speak so that we can argue with them and disagree with them. And also they have human rights too, of course. But I think it's been interesting that it's really the folks that are more not from the radical left, more from the liberal left, sort of the MSNBC left, you might say, that has been the ones demanding, I think, a greater crackdown on speech and restrictions on democracy.
It's so fascinating to me because it's such a bastardization of terms. Because by definition, liberal, if someone is against free speech and they're calling themselves a liberal, or they want opponent candidates taken off ballots, or they're trying to shut people down or the internet or deplatform people, it's all these things are very illiberal.
Yes.
So it's interesting how the terminology is being used when someone says, oh, that person is super liberal. And what they mean is they're super pro censorship and they're anti-free speech and they were pro lockdown and pro mandate and all that.
Right.
I'm like, isn't the word liberal based in liberty, based in freedom, based in individual rights and so on? So it's fascinating how this inversion's happened. And I think the way the terms are also understood, I've noticed in the conservative or right wing sphere is actually is kind of the opposite. So they view people on the left and leftists as being the ones who are pro-censorship and anti-free speech and so on, and that liberals are the ones who are more reasonable and allied with sane conservatives in that regard. But it's, what do you think of that?
No, I think you're, I mean, first of all, the observation is absolutely spot on. It's confusing when you're like, those, the most liberal people are illiberal. Doesn't make any sense. Except for it does, yeah. Obviously. We know what everyone means when they talk about that. I think another interesting example that I'm obsessed with and is at the heart of my book, San Francisco, is just that the most compassionate people are engaged in the greatest amounts of cruelty. Mm. So to give an example of it, I would keep discovering, you know, psychotic people, mentally ill, deeply addicted people on the streets, you know, vulnerable, naked, you know, the women on the streets that are homeless and usually addicts or some combination of mental illness or like basically 100% sexual assault for women on the street. When I interview women on the street, it's like 100%.
Wow.
And multiple times, horrible situation. I've discovered a guy on the street that had a broken hip. I've discovered, you know, people that are in just terrible situations. They need to be taken to hospital, you know. But the most compassionate people, or the people that say they're the most compassionate, are making the case, no, you should just do whatever they want. And so you're affirming a psychiatric disorder effectively on the streets. So yeah, things become their opposite. I mean, not to get too fancy, but I mean, that is kind of Hegel and stuff, right? Yeah. It's that these things, like the seed of its destruction lies in, or the yin and the yang. There's the destruction comes from within, you know, the opposite is embedded in the thing itself. So definitely think that that's the case with both of those examples of compassion and liberalism. These values have to be in relationship to other values. And in the case of, well, I think in the case of liberals becoming illiberal, in some ways, it's also a view that compassion and caring are the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Haidt's work, the psychologist, he says basically what we call progressivism is basically a rejection of all traditional values except for one, which is caring. Mm-hmm. So it's in the name of caring that progressives would deprive you of your free speech rights.
Yeah.
You're going to say hurtful things, and we have to protect people from hurtful things, and therefore we have to deprive you of your free speech rights. That's basically the rationale.
Gotcha. So when you use the term progressives, are you talking to people who are in that liberal sphere, but who are even further along with it? Is that what progressive means to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think progressive probably defines those folks. I think progressives defines... For me, progressives is like synonymous with woke.
Okay.
You know, we actually had it, my colleagues and I, when we had the subtitle, we were trying to forget the subtitle of San Francisco. The original subtitle was Why the Left Ruins Cities. And then there was some disagreement about that because there are people on the moderate Democrats who would still identify as part of the left that would like to have, you know, a better response to this issue. So we landed on progressives. And yeah, I think it's really the progressives who are sort of, you know, they're not really the radical left and they're not really what we'd call liberal, but they're almost like a group. They tend to be for censorship. They're for, you know, affirming psychiatric disorders. They're in the grip of victimhood ideology. Mm-hmm. And I think victimhood ideology is the central motivating, animating ideology behind what you would call the progressive movement. And I mean, Elizabeth Edwards to AOC.
Yeah. So I know I've read your book, San Francisco. It's a brilliant and eye-opening read because first time I ever came to San Francisco was in 2019. And I'm very well traveled. I've been to many dozens of countries. I've been to hundreds of cities. And I remember coming in 2019 and seeing things that I've never seen in all of my travels. I've been back to San Francisco multiple times since then. I came last year again actually to interview Elon, and the day before that interview I did a 10-mile walk around the city just to see, okay, I have a certain vision of it in my mind from 2019. Has it gotten better? Has it gotten worse? I don't want to have an inaccurate view of what it is just based off things I'm seeing on social media or certain videos or whatever. So I took a stroll, you know, went to Tenderloin downtown, all of that, Market Street, and it was probably worse than in 2019. It was a bit more dead. It was more of a dead zone. It maybe it never quite recovered from the shutdowns, but just despair is the word that I would use to describe it. Just some of the things that I saw down there just in the few days that I've spent and seen it. And it was blowing my mind coming from the UK. I was like, I've never seen this in the UK. I've never seen this anywhere in Europe. I haven't seen this in Africa. I haven't seen it in the Middle East. And so I was really interested to read your book just to find out what's how did it get like this? Especially because the thing I kept hearing was, oh, Zuby, it didn't used to be like this. If you came to the city 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, it was beautiful. It was so much cleaner. There weren't all of these problems. So obviously I want people to read your book, but can you give us an overview of what is the situation and how did it get there?
Okay. Wow. Mm. When should we start? What year?
When did you first move to the area?
I visited California when I was 15.
Okay.
And my parents are psychologists and my aunt had schizophrenia. So we would see people that were clearly mentally ill on the street and I would ask my parents about it. Mm. So there was already homeless, mentally ill people on the streets in the 80s in San Francisco. Moved out here in 1993, right after college. And there was an open drug scene across the street. I knew drugs well enough. I mean, I'm not bragging, but I knew some amount about drugs. I've never tried heroin, but sure. It was clear to me that was a heroin scene, and it was often young, upper middle class kind of types, recent college grads that had open sores because the heroin was black tar heroin and it was causing these skin problems. And they were just, this is very junky behavior, if anybody, if you know what I mean. So that was there already in San Francisco. There was already a big homeless problem. It was already being debated.
Was this downtown?
Well, that was in the Mission where I was. But it was, modern homelessness, I mean, the word goes back to the 1920s. At a minimum, I may go back further, but I certainly found it in the literature going back to the 20s. But what we call modern homelessness really emerges in the 1980s, and it's really two different things coming together. The first was the deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill, taking them out of psychiatric hospitals, and literally, in some cases, putting them on the streets with a little bit of money and some sort of, federal support, but basically being on the streets to fend for themselves. It was that extreme. And then the crack epidemic. And so you really have the confluence of these two things. Making it worse is that, progressives, I guess you would say the left, were claiming that this was a housing problem, early on claiming that this was just a poverty problem and saying it was a consequence of Reagan's tax cuts. And there was always a mythology that it was because of Reagan. So it was a problem then. And then to affirm, basically to say we should just give people money. Well, if you go give addicts money, the people go, that's stereotypical or whatever. It's like, okay, you have no idea because you give me addicts money. It's like the worst thing you can do. They're going to use it to maintain their habit. So that was basically going on. So you get this kind of affirmation of homelessness by the San Francisco city government and by other progressive governments starting in the 80s. There was a period where it got a little bit better, actually, in the early 2000s, like the first decade of the 2000s, it got slightly better, maybe 2005. There was even stories that like on Skid Row in Los Angeles, where it's also a big epicenter, the things were getting so much better that when like Hollywood film productions would want to shoot in Skid Row, they'd have to add homeless people to the streets. It wasn't enough what they had. But then things really just start to get much worse from 2005 until, 2017, 2018, when you arrived, getting in crazy levels. We were in California, both at the city and state level, paying people to be homeless. We were actually, $600 a month cash welfare payments for someone coming to San Francisco. They could also get a few $100 in food stamps, which you can sell in Chinatown for cash. And incredibly, there was so much money that really there was a huge decline in panhandling. Like the addicts didn't even need to panhandle that much anymore because they had so much cash available to them. And then you had the opioid epidemic creating a whole set of new addicts from overprescription of opioids. And the word gets out and people increasingly attract. People come to San Francisco. They come to Los Angeles. Many factors. We also started to decriminalize hard drug use under 3 grams. Proposition 47 passed in 2014. You basically, there's a lot of different laws that have passed. I sort of summarized it in the book that it was, on the one hand, it was incremental. On the other hand, there were some big things. But basically, we just start reducing the consequences for public intoxication, public drug use. And what we call homeless encampments are what European researchers famously called open drug scenes, which is basically that's where the drug, there's drug dealing going on, and the addicts that go there and buy from the dealer, you'll see it happen. They'll just go there and they'll smoke, or they would inject.
Yep, seen it.
And so then like they, and they don't want to, they just, they're in such a hurry to do the drugs, and then they would stay there and they would just sleep there. Mm. And so one of the characters, one of the real life characters in San Francisco, you know, he would say, you know, I had a room at a shelter a few blocks away, but I would stay right there because I wanted to be that much closer to the dealers. So you start to get open drug scenes all across San Francisco, you know, really around San Francisco. COVID hits, and then the response to COVID was so over the top, and then you start to shut down businesses. So you start to get this dynamic where stores are leaving, and it's continuing. Yeah. You know, and the downtown San Francisco is increasingly just a wasteland at this point.
Yeah, it's a dead zone. It's weird. I've described it to so many people in different places, and people always think I'm exaggerating. They always think I'm exaggerating, and I'm like, man, I'm not. I have no dog in this fight. I'm not just trying to make anywhere seem bad or sound bad or whatever, or even blame it on some political side. I'm just like, man, as someone who naturally, as I think most people do, if you see human suffering with your own eyes and it's perplexing and baffling and you're just like, how on earth is this okay? I remember the first time I came here, and it was about 9 p.m. on a Saturday evening, and I was somewhere between downtown and the Tenderloin area, and there was like a small park or grassy area. This is not even 9 p.m. It's maybe like 8 p.m. Saturday evening. People are going out to restaurants, families strolling by, whatever. And there were about 15 to 20 guys in this grassy area all just shooting heroin. I've never just seen that with my own eyes. And it, the weirdest thing about it was it felt like I was the only one who could see it.
Mm-hmm.
People were just walking past as if it was completely normal. I'm there just wide-eyed, like, what the heck? Like, how is this okay? How is this permissible? And, you know, they're all just casual there, like tying each other's arms up and heating up. My mind was boggled. I was just like, how on earth is it like this? And I remember I went, I was actually staying with a friend, and I was telling him about just some of the things that I'd seen downtown. And his response was, dude, why were you there? Like, right. he's like, I've never even seen that because I don't go there. Like, I never step foot there. And then I was like, I get that, but isn't that part of the problem? I mean, if people don't even see what the consequences of this are because they're a couple miles away from it in a nicer area, and then you've just got this area right in the middle of your own city where all of this is happening, and you just have thousands of people who are drug addicted. I saw a stat the other day. I think it's, what, 3 people per day dying?
Yeah.
In San Francisco on the street, 3 people per day dying of overdoses. And it's awful. It's awful. And it's crazy how if you genuinely care and want those people to be better and want action to be taken, you get framed as the bad guy. You get framed as the guy who's not compassionate, or you get framed as, and it's just so backwards to me. I find it very bewildering.
Yeah. It's very upsetting. And I have a very complicated relationship to the issue, even. I sometimes kind of pull back from it for a while. Look, we had 112,000 people die of drugs last year. That's up from 20,000 in the year 2000. 112,000. Of those, 75,000 were from fentanyl. Fentanyl, you know, it looks better because they're smoking it rather than injecting it. But there turned out that there was some people that were always put off by injecting, and they're more open to smoking. And so you've actually increased, fentanyl has increased the number of people that are using. It's almost as though the society has decided that they would rather see a million people die over a decade than actually intervene and provide the intervention that addicts need. Everybody sort of agrees that you need drug treatment, and you need, you know, Suboxone, which is a replacement therapy for opioids, or you should have some rehab, and there's a lot of money that we put on this. But the part that people, that at least the politicians and the interest groups that control them, don't want to do is impose the intervention. Addicts need, so traditionally addicts would get in such a bad way that they would break the law. And then you break the law, and then that's the chance for the intervention. And you go to court, and the judge says you can go to jail or you can go to rehab. Well, they took that away, basically. So you go to so first of all, you don't get arrested because the cops know that the DA can't prosecute you for possession. So they, you know, they literally revive people 10, 20 times with Narcan, and they just end up delaying the day of death until some other time. And so they end up, you know, you revive somebody 30 times and then they die. And increasingly, the Narcan doesn't work. Because they've developed a tolerance to it. They're smoking so much fentanyl that the Narcan isn't enough to get them out of it, and they die that way. So there was a period where they first started introducing Narcan. I think it was maybe 2019 where you saw there's a huge increase of deaths, and then there was sort of a plateau or maybe even a slight decline, and then it shot back up again. And it appears as though like the Narcan worked for, you know, like a year or two, and then it just stopped working for people, and the death rate increased, kept going up.
Wow. So 112,000 deaths per year. And that makes me wonder, if that's the number dying, how many more near-death overdoses were there?
I mean, people are being Narcanned constantly. I mean, it's an insane situation. I've seen it. So you're out there, and everyone's using, and then somebody ODs, and they either have Narcan or they yell for Narcan, and then you get two fire trucks or a fire truck and an ambulance show up with like five people, you know, from the city, and then they come, and usually the person's already been Narcanned, but they're there, they got their Narcan. I mean,
it's an injection?
No, or it's now a nasal.
Oh, okay.
And it's become fashionable to like wear them on your belt so that people know that you've got, I mean, talk about virtue signaling, right?
Boy.
Yeah. I've got Narcan on me. I'm ready to save
put the rainbow
life.
Flag on it as well.
Yeah, exactly. So it's there's a lot of, Kathy Bates misery energy in the people that run harm reduction in San Francisco. There's a lot of, in the movie Misery, Kathy Bates, I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I am not, no.
She plays a character who basically discovers a famous author who had been injured in a car accident. It's a Stephen King. It's based on a Stephen King novel. She's a huge fan. She brings him back to her cabin to take care of him. And anyway, long story short, doesn't want him to get better, you know? And so there's a way in which this desire to care for others, I call it pathological altruism.
Wow.
You can go further and call it Munchausen syndrome by proxy, but you're maintaining a sickness. You know, in part, I think, so you can keep taking care of people. I'm not sure it's exactly that conscious, but when you interview harm reduction folks, whatever, they say, well, we couldn't possibly impose an intervention on this person because he has bodily autonomy. Well, he doesn't really have bodily autonomy if you're sitting there in your own excrement, smoking fentanyl and meth all day long. And those two drugs are now combined. You know, people smoke the meth so that they can stay awake while they're on the fentanyl. I mean, it's an insane, it's just an incredibly toxic combination of drugs, toxic drugs on their own. But yeah, it's more, I became interested in what is the mentality of the people that are maintaining the system? How do they justify the destruction of all these lives? And it's out of this idea that the people that are addicts are victims, and to victims, everything should be given and nothing required. And so there's this sort of, you know, but it ends up also, you end up creating a whole class of victims that you can take care of and have funding for, and your nonprofit gets money for. And it's really part of the homeless industrial complex.
Yeah. This might be a difficult question to answer because, of course, you don't know what millions of people are thinking and believing. But what is the general sentiment of that in these areas? Are people unaware? Are they generally in support of these type of so-called harm reduction policies? Would they like to draw a line in the sand, but they're afraid to speak up? Do you know what the general sentiment is?
I mean, the incredible thing is that in the polling research that's done of San Francisco voters, but also of Los Angeles voters, it's basically the same as the rest of the country. 75% of the public says that if you're arrested for using drugs publicly or defecating publicly or camping publicly, then you should be arrested and given the choice of jail or rehab, assuming you have an addiction or a mental illness or a choice of mental health care. 75% of the public says that you should not be let off scot-free. There should be some consequence. Why then do you have politicians that are constantly letting people do that? It's just a testament to the power of being a highly organized political minority that you can maintain the system. You have a governor as well of the state who is somebody that really just is always focused on grabbing the next brass ring from when he was, you know, city council to mayor to lieutenant governor to governor. Gavin Newsom really is just about his own personal ambition. Mm-hmm. He's promised to, you know, eliminate homelessness since he started 20 years ago in politics, over 20 years ago. So, and he keeps, you know, they keep coming up with new initiatives, but as long as you're not willing to actually mandate treatment to people, as long as you're not willing to have some amount of coercion or some sense of consequence for breaking the law or overdosing and dying on the street and requiring, you know, a fire truck and an ambulance to come, as long as you're not willing to have any consequence or any coercion, then there's really, you're just going to, the people are just going to keep dying. It's just that simple.
So why do people keep voting for them?
The Democrats have, well, one question is, why have Republicans failed to succeed in a state like California, where the Democrats have been in charge for so long and they are obviously not working? Mm-hmm. And worse than that, like, why have the moderate Democrats, you know, failed to have impact? And, you know, there's some peculiar, you know, circumstances in California. Republicans were very demonized for having an anti-immigration view in California. That was, I think, based on there's some economic reasons for it. Californians, you know, we're more affluent than the rest of the country. We employ a lot more Latin American immigrants. As
just to be clear, do you mean anti-immigration or do you mean anti-illegal immigration?
Well, this was in the 90s, what happened was there was a Republican governor that proposed anti-illegal immigration measures, okay, but it included, for example, not allowing immigrant kids to go to schools, not, you know, depriving access to health care. It was viewed as too extreme,
okay,
as too cruel. And then Republicans, it sort of became a vicious circle. And so Republicans ended up becoming increasingly rural, just like they in the rest of the country. Mm. I mean, California in some ways is a mirror of the rest of the country. But Republicans kind of became, they shrank in, and they kind of retreated back to their older, earlier, you know, their older values, but also in the country and in the rural areas, stopped contesting elections in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco, basically became politically extinct in those places. They then were replaced with a moderate progressive mm-hmm. competition on the Democratic Party. But even there, the progressives gained the upper hand, really starting really from the 2010 to 2020. And I think the right, whether it's the Republicans or the moderate Democrats, were not able to offer a compelling solution to the homeless problem. And the Democrats are just so much better. I mean, the left in general is just so much better with language. You know, they're so much better at, you know, just think of more like harm reduction. Yeah. Well, harm reduction policies are resulting in 112,000 people dying.
Yes.
So they might be harm reducing, but they're death increasing, mm-hmm. you know, and the right's never been able to answer that. I endorsed the former Republican mayor of San Diego in 2021 during the recall of Gavin Newsom. And we were at a press conference and the reporter's like, what would you do with the homeless? Would you arrest them? And he didn't really have a good answer to that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like the first question, you know, there is a good answer to it. But I think like people on the right really were not able to offer that. They also weren't able to, I think, offer a very compelling policy solution. Mentally ill people are not able to like shop for healthcare. They are basically, you know, you have to deal with, to provide the proper answer to this, you have to deal with some things that make everybody really uncomfortable, mm-hmm. like coercing psychiatric care. I think you answer that by saying, look, you break the law, you can either go to jail or you can go to rehab, but you can't just break the law. Yeah. Like if you don't enforce laws, then people will not follow them.
Yeah.
So, and that, you know, you kind of get some begrudging support for that. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why the Democrats have just remained so powerful in California. You know, the unions have been very influential here. We don't have a manufacturing or much of an extraction industry like you have in, you know, places like Texas or the Midwest, mm-hmm. that sort of sustains a more, you know, conservative outlook, you know. And then there's sort of culture, you know, I always call it Big Lebowski syndrome, you know.
What does that mean?
Big Lebowski syndrome is like, well, I like white Russians and he likes to smoke fentanyl. Like, who are you to judge?
Okay.
There's a kind of libertarianism there.
Laissez-faire, just
Yeah. It's in San Francisco, one of my sources calls it left libertarianism. Mm. It's you know, it's always confusing. People say, well, but California is so tyrannical about things like masks, yes, and COVID. Yep. The difference is that those are mandated for the whole population. And so the victimhood ideology says to victims, everything should be given, nothing required. But for the rest of us, we're all guilty. We're all sinners for, you know, past, you know, genocide of the indigenous people and slavery and all the rest. And we have this burden, this debt and this guilt. And so we can impose tyrannical measures on all of us, censorship, COVID mandates, you name it. But for people that we've designated victims, they actually have special rights. So even when I interview the ACLU, I say, well, what about somebody if he, you know, urinates or defecates in public? What do you do with that person? If you're saying, you're saying not to, she said, well, it depends on who is that person. Is it a frat guy or is it a mentally ill person? Oh, and so it's kind of, well, wait, so the law, but the, and we start to see this,
yeah,
where it's like, really what's being proposed is that the law be enforced unequally, you know, and I'm all for like sentences that are appropriate for the crime, sure, and should take into account mental illness. But once you stop enforcing laws against particular classes of people, you have lawlessness. And that's what's affecting San Francisco right now.
Yeah. And is that similar to what's going on with the whole shoplifting thing?
Yes. It's basically the people doing the shoplifting. I mean, sometimes they're addicts, you know, but often it's just there's shoplifting rings, and they'll work together in groups. And it's not to say that they're not, you know, using drugs or that some of them aren't mentally ill, but a lot of the heavy shoplifting rings, you know, are groups of people that are just taking advantage of the decriminalization of shoplifting items under $950. That was part of the brilliant. It was amazing if you look back on it.
It's so strange.
If you're going to decriminalize the same legislation that decriminalized 3 grams of hard drugs for possession, also decriminalized $950 worth of shoplifting. It's almost like the initiative was written to support, you know, theft based addiction.
Do you know how many people around the world I've told about that and they don't believe me?
Yeah, I mean,
I tell people that that policy exists and they're just like, come on, man. Like, that makes no sense. Why would they do that? And I'm attempting to explain it. And I do my best to sort of put myself in the most crazy progressive brain to explain it. And they still just look at me blankly like, that doesn't make sense.
It's insane. The years leading up to it, we had had something called 3 strikes, which meant that if you had 3 felony convictions, you had to, the judge had to give you 25 years, yes, or something in prison. And I agree that that was too much, but there was also all this propaganda.
Why do you think it's too much?
Well, because I do think as long as you have a system where, well, it depends on whether it's too much, but in the case of it, you started to get things like, there's all these stories that came out of people being like, they stole a pizza or something. And it was like their 3rd strike or very small things. But I do think I believe in the discretion of judges. I do think they should take into account people's circumstances. I also think we don't have a good psychiatric care system. And so if you're mentally ill and you're breaking the law and they're not mandating care for you, it's awful to end up in the prisons. Mm. I mean, one of the things that really wasn't that, you know, we did we emptied out the psychiatric hospitals, but people ended up either homeless or in prisons. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the tragedy of it. And so they were better off in the hospitals than in prison, certainly. But I would like to see them take advantage of I'd like to see some judicial discretion. Some guidelines are okay. But yeah, I mean, we basically went through just a whole decade of or two decades of propaganda that people in prison were mostly there for nonviolent offenses. One of the things I debunk in San Francisco is just that there were all these people that were in prison just for marijuana possession. That was total nonsense. I mean, it was like single, like 1 or 2% of people were in prison for.
Okay, because that's quite a pervasive myth. I've heard that persuasive one all the way from overseas.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, and they were manipulating the statistics. They were often not dealing with the fact that sometimes when you're a prosecutor and you're prosecuting somebody, you've actually got them on weapons and on violence and on drug possession. But you can't prove, maybe it's hard to get a witness to prove the violence. You've just seen beating his girlfriend or something like that. or in the case of the weapons charge. And so they end up, or they end up, you know, getting a plea deal. So you end up getting these really complicated cases where the possession was the thing that you ended up getting sentenced for. In fact, you might actually be in a situation where the people that were in prison for the drug possession, you know, were there for much more serious crimes, but they actually, they pled out and they got some leniency. And so they were only there. It only appeared that they were there for possession.
Gotcha. Where's a place that you think handles all of this well? Because mental illness is not something that's unique to California or unique to cities. This is something that exists across the entire human species, different nations, all over. And it doesn't seem, again, from lots of my travels, different countries and continents, sure, there are people with mental problems in lots of different places, but it seems to be, however it is being handled, it seems to be being handled.
Yes.
It's not just, okay, you've just got free rein to go out and do and terrorize whoever you want. So how do you have a good awareness of how other places are handling that? And what do you think is a good example or model that you think is, let's say, compassionate, fair, reasonable, just, all of these things?
Yeah, for me, I think the country that I spent some time in and focused on as sort of a model was the Netherlands.
Okay.
But you can find really every Western European country does it better than we do. Japan does it. Korea does it better than we do. Mm-hmm. China does it better than we do. Basically, everybody does it better than we do. So, you know, but I think if you kind of go, who's like really advanced? So you get a sense of like, what's the gold standard of this? It'd be the Netherlands. I mean, I tell... You know, I basically describe you, what you want is a mental health care system that is so good that there's very few people you have to mandate psychiatric care to. Mm-hmm. You want to, you know, those of us that I always say I'm a liberal in my compassion for the vulnerable, I'm libertarian in my love of freedom, I'm conservative in that. I think you need civilization for both of those things. If you have a good psychiatric care system, people with serious mental illness, including schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, will be much more comfortable being in the hospital, much more comfortable working with doctors, taking their meds, doing the things that would prevent them from having psychotic or manic episodes and ending up on the streets. You know, the Dutch are so advanced. I mean, they're now finding ways of actually, you know, one of the cases I tell in San Francisco is a case of one of the Dutch characters in the book helping a man with schizophrenia have his own apartment. Okay. And live by himself. That's huge. My aunt had good outcomes. She has schizophrenia. She lived in a group home. Group homes are great. You know, you have 6 or 9 or 12 people in a group home plus a full-time care person there. My aunt, she couldn't hold down a job, but mm-hmm. she could, and she, you know, go to the coffee shop, smoke cigarettes, flirt with the waiter. Like, that was a good outcome for her. She was never homeless. That's great if you can do it, but a lot of times people just, you need to make sure that they're not, yeah, using drugs on the street, or that they're coming, you know, make sure they're coming home. So some sort of care system like that, but you do have to have that coercion part built into it. If you do it right, it's very soft forms of coercion. Like in this case with the schizophrenic guy, they had to kind of make an intervention, get him in there, kind of stay on him, someone, you know, a relative or a family member or a social worker that they develop trust with and have a plan with, and they're sort of surrounded by people that can take care of them. People with schizophrenia are the most difficult in many okay. ways, or severe bipolar, in part because they become convinced that they don't have mental illness and they don't think they should have to take meds or be at the care home. But you start to get to more fine grades of care for people with those levels of schizophrenia in places like Netherlands. Whereas here it's like we have schizophrenic people that have been on the street for 20-30 years living out of a shopping cart. I mean, it's going to be very difficult for them to transition to living in a group home, even if they're being assaulted, or even if, you know, you end up, people's bodies just get injured and they end up getting really sick living in those environments, or they get assaulted. So we're so far from that.
Yeah.
You know, it's shocking and slightly daunting to even think about how we'd make that transition. But that is where we would want to be, is somewhere closer to where, you know, wealthier families do a better job of taking care of their loved ones. But we even see, you know, it's interesting watching Britney Spears, you know, struggle, you know, with her father to get the care she needs. And becoming empowered enough to kind of get free of care and sort of seeing her struggle with her mental illness publicly. Even wealthy families struggle with this in a place like California because the law is so much against them.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, it's such a, it's a complicated issue. But it's strange how there's this group that is so keen on enabling the bad behavior, enabling criminality, enabling people to either become victims and or become predators of just everyday people who are going about their business. It leads me to a question, which is quite an open-ended one, which is, what is your, what's your perspective on where the USA is right now in terms of challenges, opportunities, threats? Where do you see this country going over, let's say, the next decade?
Oh, it's such a good question. I struggle with it. I mean, I think that one can tell a story about the United States as in a state of decline. Mm-hmm. You know, the average age of a civilization is, you know, 350 years. And so maybe we've peaked and we're declining. There's certainly a lot of evidence for that. I mean, the educational attainment, the low levels of reading, the huge levels of political polarization, the drug deaths that we just talked about. I think it's pretty easy to tell, you know, the demand for censorship, the rising intolerance.
Reducing life expectancy.
Reducing life expectancy. One, yeah. You know, overweight, obesity, diabetes. Mm. These, you know, it's a pretty grim picture. I'll say on the other side of it is that kind of compared to a lot of other countries, we continue to be freer and richer. I mean, we have, you know, on the freedom side, I've been working on censorship now for a year and a half, and we have much more freedom thanks to the First Amendment and thanks to the culture. I mean, Europe, they are going along with having a government censor.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. In the UK, Constantine Kizin says that there were 3,000 times that the police visited people's homes.
Oh, yeah, I know a few of those people.
That's amazing. Yeah,
I personally know people who have had police visits for.
That's just shocking to us, right? Yeah. In the United States and Brazil. So it's sort of worse almost everywhere, including countries that we think of as Western countries committed to free speech. They're not. So in that department, we're doing great. On the prosperity side, abundant energy. It's so important. We have abundant oil and gas. The world is still very much increasing its use of oil and gas. Electric cars have not made much of a dent there, and they're probably not going to. I mean, our Europe and Asia would love to have the abundant oil and gas reserves that we have. They don't have them. We obviously have a border that's absolutely out of control.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
You know, at the same time, you know, bringing in a lot of immigrants and having your population grow and having, you know, some, you know, preferably you'd want both low skill and high skill immigrants, but that tends to be very good for your GDP to have all that labor coming in, as opposed to being in a country where your population is shrinking and you end up with a demographic crisis because you don't have enough people to basically sustain an elderly population, which is what we're having in Japan and Korea. In that department, we're doing well. We're going to have to integrate a lot of people. It's a difficult challenge. Our social services are overwhelmed. I'm not at all suggesting that the border crisis is good or something. Yeah. But you kind of go like on these big macro things, when you look at it like, you know, a Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, or if you look at it like an economist would look at it, you kind of go, you know, you got a lot of cheap and abundant energy and a lot of potentially cheap abundant labor. We should be good. There's just this huge culture war and political war problem that's preventing us from actually addressing the border crisis, for example. Yeah.
It's interesting because I hear what you're saying there, but I also think that there's a time, I think GDP is a useful measure for some things, but I think most Americans will be like, who cares if the GDP number is technically going up? If our social fabric and culture and laws and actual day to day, I mean, the prices in this nation are out of control.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I mean, I'm from the UK, and for most of my life, the USA was noticeably cheaper than the UK. Mm-hmm. I noticed a change. When would it have been? It would have been sort of mid to late 2010s. just this complete inversion happens. I come to the US now. Sure, I go to a lot of big cities, but I've also been to smaller places in rural. And every time I buy something, every time I go to a grocery store, a restaurant, a hotel, whatever, I get sticker shock. And, you know, I'm pretty well off. And I don't get how most people are going through this. It's just gotten out of control. Like, a lot of things have doubled or tripled over the last 4 or 5 years in terms of the price.
And once the prices go up, they don't seem to
go down. So I think that's the thing. It's like, by some measures, an economist could look at certain numbers and go, oh, you know, GDP is going up and the stock market isn't, you know, near an all-time high. But it's like the average person is struggling much more than they were, let's say, a decade ago. The price of goods is totally out of control. It's expensive to fill up your car. All of these things. So
I guess maybe the biggest is the interest rates are now high, so it's hard to buy a home, right?
Yes, exactly. So you even have a lot of young people who, in a perfect world, in a perfect, you know, they would like to get married. They would like to buy a house. They would like to become parents and so on. But those very basic things are increasingly out of reach. You have the same problem in the UK, but I think in the US, it's based on what I've seen, it seems to be running away even faster here in terms of being able to achieve some of these simple things. And I know that a significant percentage of people my age and younger, especially people in their 20s or teens, there's this sense of demoralization and lack of hope. And I think that pessimism, I don't know how you measure it, you can do polling data, but that pessimism itself is a huge problem, because I think a lot of the American dream, I think the American dream is a beautiful thing, but I think that's always been based on the idea that each generation is going to have it better than their parents. And I think that now that is way more up for debate if the, let's say, Generation Z are going to be better off than, you know, millennials or Generation X, or let alone boomers and so on.
I really agree. I think that we don't have the foundational myth of the United States, you know, of this promised land, you know, of the city on the hill, of a place of opportunity. Boy, that just seems dead or cringe, particularly among, you know, younger millennials and Zoomers. So I worry about that. I mean, if you don't have that, then really nothing, you can't do anything else because you don't have the proper motivation.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's a motivation crisis. I think there's consequences of social media we're seeing where, I mean, you need a certain industriousness, you need a certain ambition, a certain belief in the country that, you know, you see in the speeches more on the right of Vivek Ramaswamy sort of has some more of that, or the sort of and obviously the Indian and South Asian community sort of embodies so much of that, the hard work and the ambition, the entrepreneurialism. But yeah, absolutely. I think it's hard. I mean, it's like a generation that was raised to think that, you know, that America is, you know, terrible place, you know, horrible history, that the world is coming to an end from climate change, that the society is fundamentally unfair as opposed to actually being fundamentally fairer than any society has ever been. So I do worry about that. I think it's I think we're at a moment that requires a kind of back to basics, a back to some, you know, basic foundational values of, you know, what we say, free speech, but also hard work and belief and optimism and sense of human potential and a sense of agency. I mean, that's the thing that's so disturbing, is that there's just not, like, you don't see young people that really believe that they're going to be able to achieve that. And so you end up getting a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if you don't actually believe that you can make your life better, then you're not going to make your life better.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not sure what, I mean, you'd like to think that some sort of political leader could do that, or some sort of spiritual movement. Mm. I mean, I'm very interested in sort of the ways in which I see people trying to find a new spirituality, whether coming back to Christianity or Judaism or Islam or whatever, or just even finding the spirituality in atheism or agnosticism. Something that gives people a relationship to the transcendent and also a feeling of gratitude. Those are the two things that seem to be missing from so much of people's lives. We know that a sense of those two things are very motivating for people, since their lives really matter.
Yes.
You know, that every moment matters, every conversation, every opportunity to realize yourself in some, you know, bigger way. Mm. Yeah. You know, that was there that was still there. I think with Gen Xers, still there from the 60s era, but I don't see it now. It seems like you see people, there's some lights of it.
Yes.
But it doesn't seem to, there's still a sense of pessimism in the society.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting you went there, because I was going to ask, what role do you think that religion or faith or lack thereof is playing in all of this?
I mean, increasingly, I think it's sort of fundamental. You know, I am sort of still surprised at hearing myself say that. I have atheist friends that are incredible. I mean, Jonathan Haidt and Steven Pinker and Constantine and others that are self-identified, you know, atheists, or at least deeply agnostic, and they have a lot of motivation. They find a way to be excited, but I think most people, they need some sort of faith.
I think they're all
some
exceptions.
Sense of transcendent. Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
I think they're all exceptions. I don't think that scales.
I don't think so either. I think that we want to think that we have a soul, that we're different than other animals, that there is, you know, a God, and there's some transcendence, there's something after this world. You know, we certainly, no one's, you can't prove that there's nothing there. So agnosticism is the most, is more intellectually honest than atheism. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, you know, Churchill has been tied up with the country. You know, you have people who have wanted to believe that they're citizens of a special place. And America has been, I mean, the most special in that sense of opportunity. So I would love to see a return to some sense of faith and patriotism. I mean, these are the values I think that get coded as conservative. But but I think if you talk to a lot of liberals even will acknowledge that something's really broken.
And I'm seeing people looking for it in and trying to fill the religion hole in all sorts of different ways.
Yep.
That's been very clear and apparent to me for over a decade, honestly. And I think that, I mean, whether it's wokeism, all these different isms and schisms, and even the way that people responded to a lot of the pandemic stuff, and the way they became, COVID became their religion.
Absolutely. Right?
The vaccination became baptism. The, you know, the mask became some type of talisman, or like it logically, it wasn't making sense from a scientific perspective, lots of the behavior, but the tribalism and the way that people were, I was just like, man, this is the religious impulse being applied in a very overzealous fashion to something that you are labeling as science. I see the same with like lots of these different movements. There's this religious zeal to them, but it's totally secular, and there's no forgiveness and there's no redemption.
Right.
It's like a horrible secularized version of
the worst parts of religion, none of the best parts.
Yeah, it's like gutting the real frame and truth of it, and yeah, just taking it. It's fascinating because I've noticed both privately and even publicly that a lot of people who previously would have called themselves atheists, at a minimum, and I think including some of those names you mentioned previously and many more even public figures, they've softened their view of Christianity and religion as a whole. You can throw in someone like Joe Rogan in here, right? Who he would be considered an agnostic, but if you listen to a podcast from 10 years ago, he's very antagonistic towards religion. He thought it was stupid, the whole Christianity thing, whatever. Whereas now he's definitely curious, and he can at least acknowledge, okay, this gives people a sense of meaning, purpose. You know, there's lots of intelligent there's intelligent arguments for it. It's not just mythology and random stuff that people made up. There's all this history here, views around family, about parenthood, about how you treat and love one another, all of these things about forgiveness. So even people who are not all the way there yet, I'm finding a lot of hearts are softening in that regard.
Yeah.
And then also a lot of people who are formerly agnostic, I can think of some pretty big examples who just full on going and embracing Christianity, or in some cases, Islam or Judaism, other religions. And so it makes me wonder if we're at the very early stages of some type of resurgence, revival. It's like this experiment has kind of run, and it didn't lead to, if I think back to the atheist movement in the 90s and early 2000s, from what I observed, it seemed like a very prevalent belief that, hey, if we can just get people to stop believing in God and religion and any type of superstition, whatever, then we're going to just enter this Zen-like, hyper-rational, hyper-kind, and no discrimination, less polarization, more forgiving world. And it's very much been the opposite. That the sort of proof is in the pudding. It's like, okay, well, that's not what happens. Sure, that works for some individuals. There are individuals who are able to, you know, disregard all that stuff and maintain their mental well-being and their values and their morals and the way they treat others and their sanity and however they find the meaning, purpose, community, all of those things. But again, as I've said, it clearly does not seem to be scaling.
Right.
What seems to be happening is that hole is just being filled up by things that are less truthful and far worse for both the individual and humanity as whole. People are falling into all sorts of nihilism.
Yes.
And just other forms of tribal warfare.
I mean, it makes me wonder, like, when was the last time you saw in pop culture, movies or TV or something, a positive depiction of somebody on a religious quest or achieving a religious? I mean, did you ever see Fleabag?
I haven't seen that.
That's, you know, it's a lovely two-season TV show out of Britain. And, you know, without giving any of it away, she falls in love with a priest. And kind of there's a moment at the end where it's sort of she's overcoming a sex addiction. So she's sort of coming to a spiritual reality, but it doesn't really go all the way or anything. Mm. I mean, I still think that depiction would be viewed as cringe or corny or something.
Actually, I can think of one.
Yeah.
Although it was an independent movie, but I guess an obvious one is like Sound of Freedom.
Uh-huh. Right.
Yeah.
Where they have a purpose, which is to rescue kids.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Well, the thing that blew my mind most in that movie, obviously it's based on a real character, but just him sitting, having a meal with his family. And I think they've got like five or six kids. And it just rung in my head that I cannot remember the last time I saw like a big family with a lot of kids in almost any type of media.
Right.
It's normally one or two. It's normally two. And it's rarely even three. I remember being surprised when I saw the second Avatar movie and the couple had three kids.
Uh-huh.
I was like, oh, like it stood out. Like I didn't notice it was rare until I noticed that. And I was like, huh, that's rarer than I previously thought.
Or it's sort of portrayed as sort of
super dysfunctional.
Yeah. It was like sort of like a prejudicial father, like a bigoted father or whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas like the films with like a couple and one child is often sort of sad or kind of lonely. Now, there's a new religion, though, that has emerged, including as Joe Rogan's religion, which is the religion of UFOs.
Okay.
UFOs are, I think, like when I was with Joe asking about UFOs, we're talking about UFOs, he said, well, I know that I want to believe. He says, I want to believe. So yeah. if you say you want to believe, that's a statement of religion. I was more like, I'm not sure if I want to believe because we don't really know. What if they're bad, you know? But I think that there's clearly that's a very powerful new modern secular religion. And I mean that whether or not you think that UFOs are real, in other words, if you think that there's something, you know, actually there in terms of a non-human intelligence, but it has really grown as like a movement of people. And I, you know, there's certainly been some cases where people have, it's been harmful. There's been some UFO cults and, you know, famous one where people have killed themselves.
I'm not actually familiar with these.
I mean, they're hardly worth mentioning. Mostly it's sort of a benevolent movement. You know, they're sort of, you know, they're seeking greater government transparency, which I support. They, you know, there's a sort of a view of being part of the universe. I mean, there's something really quite lovely about it, regardless of what you think of it. But I do think I think that it's clearly drawing power from people that I think do not get sustenance from traditional religion. Although I will say it's complicated because, of course, there's some very famous Christian believers that are pro UFOs, and then there's also some atheists that hate it. Matt Walsh is very pro UFOs. Walsh being very pro UFOs, and then, you know, people like Steven Pinker and Michael Shermer, and I assume Dawkins, that from the skeptics that see UFOs as a religion and they don't have anything to do with it. But I do think that, you know, I kind of take some hope from it in the sense that I think it's hard for, like you were saying, most people to be completely atheistic. And so in the absence of a religion, we're going to create a new one.
Yeah, for sure. I have a question. You've been, for the past couple of years, you've gone deep on the investigative journalism. So how did you decide to take that path? Because I see a lot of the stuff you're doing. I'm like, man, this is going way down the, you know, really going into the rabbit hole.
So yeah, in the rabbit hole now.
Yeah. What inspired you to go there?
Such a good question. I mean, in some ways it was just failure. I mean, I had a nonprofit. I had a think tank that I co-founded in the early 2000s. I left in 2016. I was trying to save nuclear plants, which were being closed down. I had some supporters, but they did not like what I was saying because I was not willing to the official. There's this very small pro-nuclear movement in the world, and the official orthodoxy is that climate change is going to destroy. It's apocalyptic. That we need advanced, you know, radically futuristic nuclear like we don't have yet. We need Bill Gates to invent some magic new nuclear, and that it has to work really well with renewables. My view was climate change is real, but it's not the end of the world. The nuclear we have is fine. It's more than fine. It's actually better because we actually know how to run these plants. We don't need some new Bill Gates type plant. And that we don't really need renewables. If you have nuclear, then you don't need renewables, and renewables are bad for the environment. So this was unpopular with the tiny little group of donors that are pro-nuclear environmentalists. Long story short, I basically lost all my supporters from 2016 to 2019, except for really one. And I saw the writing on the wall, and I thought, I'm just going to have to say all of my contrarian views in a single book and hope that it sells. And that's what Apocalypse Never was. It was like a kind of Hail Mary pass. It was like, I'm just going to have to find a way to make a living as just somebody that isn't a public intellectual, basically. I mean, I'd always been writing. I'd been doing journalism since I was 15, so it wasn't like it was new. But I had sort of been a think tank guy. And with Apocalypse Never, it was like, all right, here we go. We're going to try to make this work. It did work 2020 and then San Francisco. And then the other thing that happened is that Substack shows up, which is this platform that allows people to subscribe. And I had a lot to say because on the one hand, you write two books and a lot of it's in the book, but a lot of people don't read the book, or there's stuff in the book that I wanted to surface and I wanted to hook it to news. So I started doing more reporting and writing, and Substack just started, I started making money on Substack. And, you know, by the end of 2022, I had, you know, $500,000 a year in subscribers.
Amazing.
We're at, you know, over $1 million a year now in revenue, which is crazy because you would never, I mean, I think of it as like, it's really a historic moment. I mean, if you think of like the writers and intellectuals have been working for the guys that own the printing presses for hundreds of years, even though if you can just use some Marxist language, I am the means of intellectual production. But it took this technological revolution called the internet, and it took really 20, 25 years after the internet, if you kind of look at the rise of Substack, which was also a cultural shift. People started wanting to pay, people being willing to pay for news. Now people do pay for news with subscriptions, but they'd be willing to pay one person for, you know, $5 a month. Sure. Yeah. You know, people can afford that. And the technology got good enough and became easy enough, so it started working. And I started playing with the medium. I'm still playing with it a lot. But it became – I started working on a particular style of the Substack where, like, we call it three-act structure. In the first act, I often would like to take something that's out there that people are talking a lot about and either give you some new revelation about it or debunk something, kind of hard-hitting investigative stuff. I love the classic, you know, my classic style would be like, everybody says X, but it's not X, it's Y. And then you go, and that's like act one. And then I'm like, well, then if it's Y, not X, then how come everybody thinks it's X? And then you go into act two and you can sort of explain why everybody got it wrong. And then act three, sort of how they get it right. So I started playing with that and it started working more Brod Layton over. But, you know, then the Twitter files led to basically discovering massive abuses of power by multiple agencies, including during COVID, just any kind of abuse of power that you could imagine you would see, you know, spying without warrants, censorship, you know, basically misrepresenting vaccine data, making claims that were obviously wrong. Like if you get the vax, then you won't get sick and you won't transmit it. People claiming that the lab leak theory was racist, but somehow it wasn't racist to say that it came from people eating bats in the market, you know? And so I've really just loved coming and doing it full time. I never thought I would be able to be an investigative journalist full time because it's never been a lucrative industry, but I love it so much. I'm actually going to give a speech. I'm now, I'm sort of the first endowed chair at the University of Austin.
Awesome.
And I'm giving a speech, in a week and a half there called Empiricism as the Antidote to Ideology. And I'm somebody that loves ideas. Like I love Nietzsche. I love big ideas. I love, you know, Foucault and Hegel, or I hate them, but I like talking about ideas.
I was going to say controversial.
Yeah. But I love talking about ideas. But what really changes things are investigations. What really changes things are when you are like, you know, no, like fewer people are dying from natural disasters than ever before. It's not the end. Climate change is obviously not the end of the world. Or harm reduction is not resulting in fewer deaths, is resulting in more of them. I mean, I think the way things change is by being investigative and by revealing new truths and then also, you know, finding new ways to express them. But so, yeah, for me, it's, you know, when you guys came in here chasing a story about the beginning of the Trump Russia collusion stuff and being able to reveal new things, that really gets me excited. So it's like the thrill of, I'm a neophile in the sense I like new things. I like to, when I say, I don't find myself wanting to keep going out there and repeating myself on nuclear power after a while. It's like, I think people know what Michael Schellenberger thinks of nuclear power. It's not that interesting.
If you could know the absolute truth, full transparency on one issue or event, currently or historically, which one?
Oh man, that's such a good one. Wow. I mean, obviously I'm like 90% sure COVID leaked from a lab.
Okay.
But we don't really have 100%. So I would love to know that. I would love to know the truth of how the Trump Russia investigation began.
Okay.
I know for a fact that there's things that we still don't know about that we want to know. I want to know who in the deep state, who in the intelligence agencies, or is there somebody?
Who is they?
Yeah. Like who is there somebody there? Yeah. I keep getting the sense there's sort of like a kind of a shadowy energy, a dark energy, but there's something pushing very similar censorship initiatives in the United States, Canada, Western Europe, and Brazil. Mm-hmm. Like, is that, how much of that is just organic and how much of it is there like a committee of dudes, you know, like, is there a conspiracy? Is it organized?
Yeah.
Because we know because conspiracy just means a secret effort to break the law. So we know that people are breaking the law. We know there's secrecy. How organized are they? And how much of it is people just kind of, you know, making things up as they go along? You know, so yeah, those are all things I want to know. I mean, I want to know if God is real, obviously, but we won't find out until later.
Yeah, man. Michael, what have you got a plan for the rest of the year? Anything people should be looking out for?
We're going to keep going after this issue of abuses of power. I just got interested in January 6th.
Oh.
Another event that we don't fully understand.
That's a weird one.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
I'm very interested. Like, I've gotten interested in how, like, there will be some, like, really significant event, and then people kind of, then they just kind of, like, it's sort of hidden in plain sight. Mm. And so the thing that's very interesting right now for me is that there were supposedly pipe bombs set to go off on January 6th in Washington, D.C. that didn't go off. FBI claims that they're looking for the people that put them there, but they don't really seem to be looking very hard. This is the craziest story. The FBI says that the cell phone data that you would have for the person that they think planted it somehow got corrupted, so we don't have that data. And all of the text messages from the Secret Service were deleted. Mm. And so we are expected to believe that, and also the video evidence isn't there. It's like the Epstein thing.
I was going to say the camera stopped working.
And the security guards fall asleep. And the injury to his neck. Nobody mm-hmm. thinks that's consistent with a hanging. Yeah. So I'm very interested in kind of going back and trying to reinvestigate some of those things. And one of the coolest things we discovered, and I didn't really quite realize until I started dealing with more whistleblowers, is that over time, people become more comfortable taking risks mm-hmm. in terms of people that know things. They become a little bit braver. We talk about how cowardice is contagious, but so is courage. And yes. So I love whistleblowers that come to me and are willing to share information. I have a good record in terms of protecting their identities. So I just am always advertising, you know, it's like, if you know something, a lot of times the people that will share stuff with me, we just found out, for example, from some sources that the FBI China Intelligence Squad, which was a 25-person squad, knew from March 20th that COVID leaked from a lab, from a confidential human source. And that, like, I'm like, how did 20, like, 25 is like a lot of people to keep a secret. Like, those of us that are trying, you try to keep secrets with your friends, you know, and your family, you know, or whatever, some secret. And like, everybody knows, right? Like, you're just like shot, like, within a year, everybody knows your secret. So how do they keep that a secret for so long? I think there's a lot of things that like ordinary folks in their day-to-day, you know, work or whatever, they know. And I'm always like, just try, you know, call me up, michaelschellenberger@gmail.com or michaelschellenberger@proton.me. Come to us with information, because I do think on these big events, you know, censorship, January 6th, COVID, there's still a lot we don't know. And mm-hmm. I think the next year we're going to see a lot of it come out.
No doubt. Well, Michael, you're doing so much awesome work. Your journey has been inspirational. You've helped millions of people. And so please keep it up. And God bless you, man.
Thank you. God bless you too, Zuby. Great to be with you.
I appreciate it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.